Good morning. I hope you are doing well this morning. We are going to kick off a new series today, and we're going to call this series Faithful. And it's going to be a journey through the book of Daniel. Like I said in my prayer, I think this is one of the most fascinating books in the Bible. It's full of super interesting stories, and it's full of prophecy that specifically has to do with the end times, and yet some of that prophecy has already been fulfilled. And so we're probably what I'm going to do, we're going to work through this book chapter by chapter, mostly verse by verse. It's going to be set up more like almost like a Bible study, because I think that there's so much in each verse and each chapter of this book that we have to go through. And so the first six chapters of Daniel are more of a narrative, and the last six chapters are more prophetic. And so probably, since we're getting close to Christmas time, I'll work through the first six narrative. Then we'll take a break, and we'll probably do a Christmas sermon series as we get close to that time frame. And then in January or February, we'll pick it back up with looking at the prophetic passages, which are fascinating to study. In fact, I think the first Bible study I ever went to was on the book of Daniel, and I remember just being in awe of things that, you know, you could just read and you're like, okay, what is that saying? But then when you begin to decode it and you begin to try to understand it, man, it is some amazing, amazing stuff. So anytime, when I started knowing that we were going to come to the end of the series on Proverbs, on wisdom, I, you know, asked God what did I need to go to next? And he led me to Daniel. I don't think I've ever preached through Daniel. I don't think I've ever did a sermon series on Daniel. And so I essentially asked God, why? Why Daniel? Why at this time? And I think it's because there's so many similarities between the world that me and you live in and the world that Daniel lived in. And you might be thinking, well, this was thousands of years ago. What similarities would there be? Daniel was living, belonging to a different kingdom, living in the midst of a kingdom that is anti-God, today we live in a world that's anti-Christianity. And so there are so many similarities that we can see in this book, and we can learn from Daniel and his response during this time frame. And so kind of give you a background or a timeline to let you know where we're at, because we're going to the Old Testament, and anytime we go to the Old Testament, I want to know where are we at on this biblical timeline. So we have Israel. Israel had become a nation approximately 1000 B.C. I've seen some dates before that. This is when Israel unites as a kingdom under Saul, and then Saul, David, and Solomon all reigned over a united, for the most part, kingdom. This was until roughly 930 BC. I've seen different dates on that too. And at this time, after Solomon's reign, Israel splits. So Israel is God's people. Israel splits into two, Israel and Judah. These are two different nations, two different kingdoms. The tribes split. Israel is the northern kingdom. Judah is the southern kingdom. They are all still God's people. God didn't desire for this split to happen. This is not something God wanted to see, but this is something the devil tries to do to God's people pretty often. So then we fast forward a couple hundred years to 722 BC, and that is when the northern kingdom, Israel, falls. It falls to Assyria. They are no longer a kingdom. They've been taken captive by another country. Judah, meanwhile, still stands. Judah is a little bit more faithful than Israel is. So God took care of Judah a little bit more, because remember in the Proverbs series, we talked about how God takes care of those who are walking the righteous path. They were a little bit more faithful. They still messed up. And so they had extra time. So another 100 years later is where we're picking this story up. The northern kingdom is no more. They've been taken captive. Judah is still a country at this point, still God's people, but they are about to be taken over as well. We know this date, roughly 605 BC, because Daniel starts out his book by saying this: in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So this gives us some timeline. We can go back and look at historical findings and say, okay, the third year of Jehoiakim, when was that? This was the time in which Jerusalem fell to the Babylonian army, who Nebuchadnezzar, we don't think, in my study, we don't think Nebuchadnezzar's the king of Babylon at this point. He eventually will become the king, which is why he's referred to as the king. But at this point, it seems like, according to the archaeological finds, Nebuchadnezzar is the leader of the armies in this region. And eventually he'll become the king, and you're going to hear a lot about Nebuchadnezzar during this series. But anyway, he comes against Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim, and I'm going to get these names wrong, just going to tell you, because I'm from Seagrove. And so these are not Seagrove names. But Jehoiakim, he is a puppet king. Up to this point, Judah, while it was still a country, it was kind of under the rule of Egypt. And so what the Egyptians done, what Pharaoh did, is he killed some of the kings, and he put in the kings that he wanted in, that he could control. And Jehoiakim's one of these guys. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, he just beats Egypt. And so when he beat Egypt, that meant Judah came under his control. So we continue to verse 2. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Now, keep that verse up there, because we're going to come back to this in a little bit. Who delivered the king of Judah into the hands of the enemy? The Lord. The Lord gave him over. The Lord delivered him into the hands of his enemy. And so what we see here, too, is that second part. He took some of the articles of the temple of God. He took some of the most important things to God's people, to Judah, to Israel, to God's people. He takes them and he carries them off to the temple of his false god and puts them in the treasure house. Now, why would he do that? Well, based off my studies, I've learned that today it's in when there's war, it's country versus country. It's Ukraine versus Russia. It's army versus army. Back then, during this time frame, it was army versus army, but the way they viewed it is it's my God versus your God. And so this was a very common thing that would happen during these wars. Whichever one won, they would take items from their God, the defeated God, and take it to the house of their God as a way of reminding them that my God is greater, is essentially what they're saying. And so as I read through Daniel chapter 1, I really paid attention to the strategy that the Babylonians used against Judah. And I want to note that strategy, and we'll tie it in later. But the first thing I see with this strategy that they used is that they targeted the faith of God's people. They targeted their faith. And so the strategy I see first is they target the faith. They take what is there, take it to their God as a way of saying, my God is greater. We think Daniel wrote this book, hence the name. And he specifically notes at the beginning of that verse, and we want to tie it in later, is that God delivered Jehoiakim. He delivered Judah into the hand. It goes to show that God is sovereign, even through the worst of times. And that's going to be a theme we see throughout this book. Let's continue verses 3 through 4. Then the king ordered Asphinaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without physical defect, handsome. Sorry, David, you're out. Both of those you're out. Showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. So what's happening here is that they are targeting, and this is number two, second part of the strategy, they are taking those of high value. These men would have been the future leaders of Judah. They would have been the future leaders of God's people. And what Babylonia is going to do is they're going to take those, the best of the best, that that country has to offer, and they're going to indoctrinate them in their ways, in their customs. They are going to try to change them from the inside out so that when they grow up, they're no longer part of God's people. They are a Babylonian through and through. And so they took those that were young, without physical defects, handsome, they had ability to learn, they were already smart. These are the best of the best. When we're looking at high school, college kids, these are the ones that they are targeting. Now think about if the U.S. was taken over, this is a pretty clever strategy. Take our young folks. Take the ones that are going to grow up and that are still learning, though. They're in that key phase in life where they're young and they are learning, the brain's still forming, and indoctrinate them, fill them up with what you want them to know. That way, when they get older, they don't follow the ways of the United States anymore. This is what Babylonian's doing. Verse 5 says, the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Now, this does not mean that they literally ate at the table of the king every night. But what this means is that they had access to the food that the king had access to. So they did not have to worry about where their meals were going to come from. They did not have to worry about what they were going to eat. The king was going to give them a daily amount of food and wine. They were going to get special treatment from the king so that 3 years after they were able to enter into the king's service. And so what I see there is that they enticed them. So that's the third part of that strategy, is to entice them. Man, that sounds pretty good. My country just got taken over. I don't know what I'm going to do. People are dying. People, obviously, if they were not handsome, if they had any type of physical defect, they didn't care about them. And the king's offering me some of the best food I probably ever ate. Yeah, I'm going to go for it. They entice them with food and wine from the king's table. They'd get special training for 3 years, and then they would get to serve the king. Sounds like a pretty good deal for those that fall into that category. We're told who falls into that category in verse 6. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We think that all four of these are descendants of King Hezekiah, the previous king of Judah. We do think that they are of nobility. We think that they were kind of high up in society. Even if they are not direct descendants of the king, these are people that were considered high up in Judah. And none of these guys at this time are over 20 years old. So we're talking teenagers that are being taken from their country to be indoctrinated in the ways of the enemy country. Specifically, obviously, we're going to pay attention to Daniel during this series. And Daniel, we think, is somewhere between the ages of 15 and 18. This is a young guy that's being taken from his home, being ripped from his family, being ripped from his way of life, being taken into another country to be indoctrinated in their ways. The chief official, verse 7, gave them new names. To Daniel, he gave the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Now, all those names you probably are familiar with if you know the story of the three in the fire. This, we read this and we're like, okay, They get new names. So what? This was a huge deal to people in the Middle East. Because today, you know, I'm named Nathan. Half of us don't even know what our name means. I think my name means gift from God. We specifically, when we named Elijah and Ezra, we thought about what did their name mean. But a lot of times we just name them whatever, and we don't really think about what their name means. But in the Middle East, in this culture, your identity was tied to your name. So whatever your name was, your identity was tied to it. And so for them to say, hey, you're not being named this anymore, I'm giving you a new name, that's like changing their very identity. And that leads to the fourth part of the strategy. I see that they wanted to change the identity of those that they took over. Daniel's name in Hebrew meant God is my judge. And his new name meant, may a God, notice not the God, a God, protect his life. Or it could mean a goddess, protect the king. So it goes from talking about Yahweh, his God, who is his judge, to maybe even saying, hey, goddess, protect the king. Showing that he's living for the king, he's living for Babylonian, not for God anymore. So this would have been a huge deal to them. We kind of read it and we're like, whatever, but this would have been huge to them to have their name changed. Not only that, but there's a chance that they very well may have to become eunuchs in order to serve in the king's presence. And basically what that means is that they had to be castrated at 15 to 20 years old to serve in the presence of the king. You talk about hard. These boys are getting ready to go through a really hard time. So I look at the strategy and I see that this scheme, this strategy has been repeated time and time and time again in the history of the world, specifically when we see one kingdom take over another kingdom. I first thought about Egypt, God's people in Egypt. We know that they were slaves in Egypt. They were there to serve Pharaoh. They're not there to serve God. They're there to serve Pharaoh. He's targeting their faith. Not only that, but they would kill, once they saw that the Israelites were becoming high in number, when a woman would have a baby, if that baby was a boy, they killed him on the spot. They took those of high value because they wanted to stop the future leaders of God's people from coming to power. They would entice them. And when I thought about the enticing part, this actually goes back to the time of the famine when Joseph had been placed strategically by God in Egypt. All of Israel comes there. And they are taken care of during this time of famine. But then when a new king comes to power, it's a gradual slope down to then become slaves to that new king, new pharaoh in Egypt. And that's exactly what happened. And then they changed their very identity. I tell you what, if you ever study that people were in slavery, that becomes their very identity. They are there to serve their master, whoever that is. And in this case, their master is not God. Their master is Pharaoh. So I see this strategy at play in Egypt, but let's go something to a little more recently. I see this strategy at play when Hitler took over Germany. He targeted their faith first. They attempted to make the 28 Protestant churches in Germany a single state-controlled Nazi church. Take their faith. Take those of high value. Did you know that they made it mandatory for kids and youth to take part in their Nazi organizations so that they would indoctrinate them so that when they grew up, they would serve the Reich? They would change their, they would entice them. I'm sure you've heard this before, and I did a little bit more study on it myself. They believed in a master race. That you had to be of Nordic descent in Germany, and you were a part of the master race at that point. That's enticing to think that you're above everyone else. And so what they would do if there was any type of physical defect, if a child was born with any issues, any problems, they would kill them. They would take them out because they didn't want to harm the future Reich or for them to breed with other people. And then they would change their identity. At their core, they didn't live for themselves. They didn't live for God. They lived for the future of Germany, for the Nazi Empire. So we see the strategy at play in wars. And we can go look at the other wars if you wanted to, and we see this strategy repeated time and time again. And do you want to know why? This isn't Hitler's strategy. This is not Pharaoh's strategy. This is Satan's strategy that is repeated time and time again, and it is being repeated before our very eyes today. Let me show you this strategy at play in Genesis chapter 3, the first sin. First, he wanted to target their faith. Genesis 3:1. He asked them, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? What he's done is he's flipped what God actually said. God said, you may eat from any tree except for this one. And he's saying, did he really say you must not eat from any tree? He's going after their faith. He doesn't want them to know really what God said. Obviously, when we talk about those of high value, Adam and Eve was God's most prized creation. They were the one part of creation that was created in his image. And so he's targeting them. He's going after them. He'd entice them. Notice what he says in verse 5. He says, God knows that when you eat from this forbidden fruit, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. In other words, hey, you want to be like God? Take this. That's enticing to Adam and Eve. And then guess what? Once they do it, once they eat the forbidden fruit, their identity has been changed. They're now sinners. They're now afraid of God, fearful to be seen. They realize they are naked. And it kind of stood out to me. You don't see Satan after that. Not right there in Genesis 3. Obviously, he gets cursed. The snake gets cursed. But he's done with them once he gets them to change their identity. This is a play that we see even still today. He wants to steal you, Christians, followers of God, from God's kingdom over to his kingdom. He wants to deport you as Daniel is being deported from Judah. He wants to deport us. He wants to take us away from following God, and so he is going to do this very thing. First, he's going to target your faith. He's going to want to steal your faith. He's going to want to take you out. He's going to want to tempt you. He's going to want to hurt you. He's going to want to get you to give up on following God. You might be thinking with the second one, hey, I'm not of high value. I don't fit that criteria that's listed in Daniel. Well, guess what? If you are a follower of God, you are of high value. If you are alive, you are of high value. God values you highly. He loves you. He values you so highly that he sent Jesus to die on the cross for your sins. And so Satan values you just as highly, not because he loves you, but because he doesn't want you in God's kingdom. He wants to indoctrinate you in his ways. Now, let's specifically talk about those, when we think about it from a practical sense, those that are of even higher value. And those are our kids, our teenagers, and our young adults. That's the group in particular that Satan is going to go after, that Satan is going to target, because they are, in particular, of high value. Their minds are still being developed at that young age. They are learning. And so he is doing everything he can, even today, to go after them. He's attacking their minds. In our colleges and universities, there are some crazy stuff being taught. Even in our school systems, there are some things being taught that should not be taught. He is trying to make them believe things that are not biblical, and that is not a coincidence. That is a part of this strategy. He's attacking their hearts as well. We all know in those teen years we make a lot of mistakes. But that's not a coincidence. That's because Satan is going after us. He's wanting to tempt us. He's wanting to lead us astray. He's wanting to fill us with shame and regret that we're going to carry the rest of our lives. That's going to hamper us down. That's going to stop us from following God as best we could. Not only that, but I don't know what sermon it was, but I remember looking at some of the mental health statistics regarding middle schoolers, high schoolers, and young adults, and they are very discouraging. Anxiety is at an all-time high. The suicide rate, I think, is tripling in middle school age groups. It's rough. That's not a coincidence. Satan is after those who are the future leaders of America, the future leaders of the church. And I think, you know, we've heard time and time again, you send your kid off to college and they come back and they're a totally different person. They've been indoctrinated in into a different kingdom than the kingdom of God. And we ask why. It's because this is Satan's strategy. Shouldn't surprise us. This is what he's doing time and time again. He entices us with sin. He makes sin look fun. He never shows you the consequences of sin. He just makes you think that sin, whatever you can do, is fun. It's the way of life. You know, a few years ago, YOLO was running around. The term YOLO, you only live once, so might as well live it to do whatever you want because you only live once. He doesn't show you the consequences of doing things that you shouldn't be doing. And then once he gets you on these first three, he changes your identity. And he begins to try to attack you. He begins to tell you you're not a child of God. He begins to tell you that God couldn't love someone like you, that you are a sinner, that you are broken, and that you might as well give up on this thing called Christianity, called following Jesus. And he doesn't just do this to young folks. He does this for the rest of your life. He tries to take you out. He wants to do this to each and every one of us. And here's the thing. God allows it. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting that God allows for all this to take place in the lives of those he loves? Doesn't make sense until you learn why. See, God allows these attacks in our life to test our faith. And that's essentially what's happening here with Judah and Daniel. We saw that Jehoiakim was delivered into the hands of the enemy. God allowed for this to happen, including allowing Daniel and his friends to be taken into captivity, to be indoctrinated in the ways of the Babylonians. God allowed it. To test them, to test their faith. We see this pattern all throughout Scripture. We see it first when they were sent into the wilderness in Deuteronomy 8:2. It says, remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what is in your heart and whether or not you would keep his commands. During the time of the judges, here's what it says in Judges 2:21. I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will instead use these other nations to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their ancestors did. You might be thinking, well, that's the Old Testament. He tested them in the Old Testament. It makes sense, but guess what? He tests us today too. Here's what James says in James 1. 2 and 3. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the what? Testing of your faith produces perseverance. In other words, he's saying you are going to be tested. Your faith is going to be tested. You're going to go through struggles. He is going to allow the enemy to use this strategy on you, on your children, on young adults, and on people in this world. As long as they're alive, they're going to be tested. It made me think, why would he test us like this? He's God. Doesn't he already know whether we'll be faithful or not? Because I think about tests in school. You know, you got to bubble in the answers, and it goes to show how good you are. Well, it gives the teacher some idea of where you're at. Our teacher knows everything, so why does he need to know where we're at? I don't think it's for God. I don't think God's doing this so that he finds out. I think God is doing this so that we find out. So that we can see where we fall short, so that we can figure out where we need to grow and ask God to help us to grow. Not only that, but James reminds us that there are positives that come with testing. He says there that the testing of your faith produces perseverance, and then in verse 4, he says, let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. In other words, what James is telling us here is you have to be tested in order to grow. It is a part of our growth as followers of God to go through tests, to go through trials, to go through tribulations in our life so that we can become more like Jesus. But here's the key. We have to respond to that testing well. That's the hardest part. Because when you live in the midst of all these other things that can entice us and lead us away from God, it's easy to go and take all of this. Instead, we've got to remain faithful. Let's continue in Daniel, verses 8 through 10. Daniel's just been offered the best food that the land has to offer. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Now, the food and wine that apparently would defile himself was probably things that was forbidden for Jews to eat, for God's people to eat. Probably pork, so no barbecue. Probably all of this food was sacrificed to idols as part of their false god worship before it would be fed to the people. And this would all go against the law that was given to the Israelites. And so Daniel is saying, hey, I don't want to eat this food. It looks great, you know, might be good food, but I don't want to defile myself because this is food I can't eat. So he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. I was listening to a Bible study, and it says, do you notice this is like the one thing that Daniel says no to? Like, Daniel went along with changing the name. We don't really see that. It probably bothered him, but he went along with it. He's probably getting to live in the palace or around the palace. He didn't go against that. It's the food in particular that he is standing up for. And what I heard is this guy that was teaching this Bible study, he said, it goes to show that you need to pick and choose where that line is, and you need to maybe not stand up against everything, because then people are just going to think you're particular, but you need to choose where you can stand up and communicate to them that you're still a follower of God. And he's specifically talking about that in the political realm, I think. Verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. Goes to show that God is even at work in the midst of this testing. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has assigned you your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So in other words, this official is like, man, if you don't eat this food, you're not going to look as good as the other ones. I heard that one of these words that are used in these verses basically refers to them. He's basically saying, hey, you're not going to be as fat as the other ones. You're not going to be as plump as the other ones. You're not going to look as healthy as the other ones. And he's afraid of the king, because if he sees that Daniel's getting special treatment, the king could cut off his head. So then, Daniel says, okay, let's go to the guard. Verse 11, Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he said, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So the guard agrees, and he tested them for 10 days. It's interesting that he comes up with this strategy. He says, 10 days, just feed us vegetables and water, and see that we are going to be just like those that are getting the choice meats, the choice wine, the best of the best that Babylonia has to offer. I wonder what is going through Daniel's head to lead him to propose this. Now, Daniel, we know from later on in the book, he's a praying man. So he probably prayed, and God led him to this. But then I have to ask, why? Because when was the last time you saw a fat vegan? I've not seen a fat vegan in a long time. The joke I heard was that when they turn, they disappear. He is proposing, though, that he is going to become a vegan. This is actually called the Daniel fast, if you've ever heard of it. He's going to become a vegan. And he's saying, compare us at the end of these 10 days and see if we look just as fat, just as good as the other ones. Now, I hate to tell you, but that's not possible. If they just ate vegetables and water for 10 days, they are not going to look as good as the ones who eat the meat and the choice foods. And so what Daniel is proposing here is a test that is not successful, will not be successful, unless God moves on his behalf. This is an act of faith on Daniel's part, and I love to see it. So then, verses 15 through 21, at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. God came through for them. That's a miracle in itself, a fat vegan. Continue. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel, in particular, could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. That will come in play later in the book of Daniel. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. So in that verse right there, we fast forwarded 3 years. So it's been 3 years. Apparently, these four men excel at their ability to learn, at the knowledge that they have. They excel at what he was asking them to do. And so they are going to be noticed by Nebuchadnezzar, and they're going to be noticed by the other officials in Nebuchadnezzar's court. Daniel, in particular, is able to see visions and dreams. Nebuchadnezzar's king at this point, and it says, the king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. Did you notice, though, in verse 17, they weren't just great learners. God gave them the ability. So God blessed them for their obedience. Continue in verse 20. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. That last verse fast forwards us to when Babylonia gets taken over by another country, but we'll pick him back up next week in Daniel 2, where Nebuchadnezzar is still king. When I read this, I just listened to some of the videos that Don's group did over the last couple years, really, on Wednesday nights, and one of the things that he taught in those videos is that when you see something that you question, like, why do they keep using that, there's a reason. And so I noticed the number 10 keeps coming up. 10 days, he made them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters. So why 10? 10 often represents testing, trials, or completeness. So think about the Ten Commandments. If you followed the Ten Commandments completely, you're going to be loving God and loving others with all of who you are. They're also kind of a test to see where you're at in your relationship with God. I thought about the 10 plagues in Egypt. They went through 10 plagues, 10 trials that really God was testing them. How far are you going to go before you let my people go? In Revelation 2:10, we're told that the church in Smyrna during the end times or around the time of the end times says, do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. So 10 is a number that keeps coming up as a number that represents trials and testing. So it made me think that maybe Daniel asked for 10 days because he knows he is being tested. And so what Daniel does is he proposes a test. He says, God's testing me, then let's test this, and God's going to be faithful. I believe that. And God was. And God made them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the kingdom. So that made me start to think about the number 10. We in our math, we use 10 as like, one of our organizing numbers. 10 is not a big number. It's not a short number either. But it shows that testing will come to the end at some point. It's not going to be forever, but it's also not just going to be short. It's limited. 10. And so I think my one point for you, my one takeaway from this Daniel chapter 1 that I think Daniel shows us is this. When we are being tested, do the right thing, even when it's hard, and God will be faithful to lead you through the time of testing. Do the right thing. I don't know what the right thing is for you today. I don't know what situation you're going through. I don't know where you are being tested. I don't know what trials or tribulations you are going through. But I've got a feeling at some point during this trial, at some point during this tribulation, you're going to have the choice to do the wrong thing or the right thing. And the right thing may not make sense. The right thing might go against everything that you believe in. The right thing may go against the world's wisdom. But we done talked about during the last series, you follow God's wisdom, not the world's wisdom. It may not make sense in the middle of it, but do it anyway. If you have the chance to love your enemies, do it. If you have the chance to sacrifice, do it. If you have the chance to give, do it. If you have the chance to show grace, do it. Do the right thing, even when it's hard, even when you don't want to. Remain faithful. And if you are, God is faithful. If you are, God will get you through whatever you are going through. If you are, the time of testing will come to an end. At some point in your life, the time of testing will stop. And even if it is for the rest of your life is really small in the grand scheme of all eternity. Your life is nothing compared to all of this. Testing will come to an end, but you have to remain faithful, and God will be with you in the middle of it. So I don't know who that was for today. I don't know who is being tested. I don't know who's going through a trial, a tribulation, a family issue, a personal issue. You're going through a rough week, maybe. I don't know. But what God wanted me to tell you today is do the right thing. Even if you don't want to. Even if it is hard. Do the right thing. Daniel was being tested, and his test was a whole lot greater than ours. I mean, none of us are being taken into Russia and being indoctrinated into Russia's ways. More likely, I would say if that had to happen, it would probably be from China. We'd be indoctrinated in China's ways. None of us are going through that. But you may be going through something that no one else sees. You may be going through something that keeps you up at night, that has you down, has you depressed, has you anxious. Whatever it is, there's going to come a moment in that time where Satan's going to entice you to do something. He's going to put the food out on the table because you're highly valued. God loves you. Satan wants to take you out. He's targeting your faith, and there's going to be that food laid out on the table. Do the right thing. Don't take the food. And you could say you're testing God in that. I call it an act of faith. You're taking an act of faith, believing that God is going to come through for you in a way that is amazing, that will bring others and you into a closer relationship with Him. And so I want the worship team to come on up. And we're getting ready to sing the last song today. And the last song is going to be Promises. And what this song goes through is that, you know, even though storms may come in your life, even though the rough times may come, God is faithful. He's never going to leave us. He's never going to forsake us. He's going to be with us. And He's going to lead us through whatever we're going through. So if you will, let's stand to your feet and let's pray. Heavenly Father,